it comes to me for defining what is arthritis. I would say that arthritis is a state when you become aware about your joints painfully. Because still then, like our kids take parents take them for granted, we do the same thing with our joints or with our back. And I think that is the right description of arthritis. So with these few words, I would invite Dr. Pradeep.
Can you hear me? Oh. Can we do without this? Is that... Can you... It's very kind for you all to invite me. I'm not somebody from the Mumbai medical scene, and I've worked all my life in PGI Chandigarh and now for some years in Australia. Can I have one of the traditions that really influenced me in Australia is that whenever we start a talk, there is a moment when we remember the elders and the people who have been before us in a particular organization. So coming to this Mecca of learning, I was acutely aware of its enormous history, its significance in our national scientific firmament, and also the lurking spirit of Homi Bhabha. So I take a few minutes. You had a very charismatic person. This is something that you all know. J.R.D. Tata called him a scientist, engineer, master builder, administrator, steeped in humanities, in art and music, and that Homi was a truly complete man. So I am going to use a little bit about history, a little bit about art, the story of two people who probably never met, to try and build up a story of what's happened with arthritis over the last 125 years. Homi Bhabha himself said this very poignantly: since I cannot increase the content of my life by increasing its duration, I will increase it by increasing its intensity. Art, music, poetry, and everything else that I do have this one purpose: increasing the intensity of my consciousness and life. So I will use that as a starting point. He was a master in many ways, from the allegorical to the fairly abstract and to the sublime. And I'm grateful to Professor Arun Grover, who you all know very well, for providing me with some of this material. And this institute of yours is a testament to his vision. He also kept very interesting company. And I use this photograph, he's here with Albert Einstein, to reflect on how an image could possibly have something to do with medicine. And as you all know, Albert Einstein died of a ruptured aortic aneurysm. And when they are walking in Princeton, against the breeze, it is quite possible that this picture shows the aneurysm that ultimately took his life. Einstein didn't believe in doctors. Michael DeBakey and Denton Cooley were ready to operate on his aortic aneurysm, and he refused surgery. So with that, let us start. I bring you greetings from the city of Bundaberg, where I work. This is our river, looking very placid. It can be a raging torrent at times. And right there in the corner is Bundaberg Hospital, where I work. And we'll start with this. Now, this is a painting, which is a masterwork of Pierre Renoir, the master of Impressionism. And you can see the ease with which he has painted the languid hedonism of Paris in the 1870s. We will talk about Pierre Renoir, his work, and reference Sir William Osler, who many believe is the father of modern medicine. He is a man who introduced several innovations in teaching medicine, bedside teaching, journal clubs, everything that we now consider as part and parcel of our development owes it to the vision of this man. So I'll just show you two pictures. They don't project particularly well, but you can realize here the sublime translucency of this face and the quality of the brushwork, where every strand of hair, this young girl's face, is visible. Likewise, the intensity of these flowers. These were painted by Renoir in the 1880s, and that is a photograph of the man, a dapper man, who in the late 1880s developed a disease which was then called arthritis deformans, which we now call rheumatoid arthritis. So what was the state of medicine concerning arthritis at that stage? And this is a quotation from Sir William Osler as a young man who said that he wanted to head out of the back door whenever an arthritis patient came in through the front door, thereby testifying to this frustration in treating these patients because he had very little to offer them. In 1892, and that's a photograph of his hands, and you can see the swollen knuckles. It didn't make much difference to his brushwork. This was another work painted in 1892, and you can see that it's still pretty much the same quality of work. In 1892, Sir William Osler married Grace Revere. Grace Revere was the granddaughter of Paul Revere, who was famous in the American Civil War, not the Civil War, but the War of Independence, as a man with the long midnight ride. And it's all recorded in verse, the midnight ride of Paul Revere. Also in 1892, William Osler published the first large textbook of medicine. And this is a flyleaf of its front cover, published in 1892. And he described arthritis deformans as an incurable disease. Too often it invades successively all the articulations, and in 10, 15, or 20 years, the crippling becomes general and permanent. It's a definition that fits very well with untreated rheumatoid arthritis. So what did he offer as therapy? It's useless to saturate the patient with iodide or potassium, salicylates or quinine. So he had it wrong there. Both salicylates and quinine became part of the therapeutic armamentarium for this disease. He talked about arsenic, which everybody talked about those days. Nobody would talk about it today. Hydrotherapy, which we still talk about. Massage, which we still talk about. Good results is largely from a change in scene and climate, which is what people were advised to do, move to a warmer climate, and careful regulation of the diet, which he didn't specify. So by 1900, Renoir had definite signs of deformities in his hands, but he still had the quality. You can see that his finger is stiff and these knuckles are overly prominent. But he still had the skill to paint this self-portrait of his. But he has now, compared to what he was just 10 years ago, become physically an old man. You can see that his trousers are just hanging on his legs. So the disease has taken hold well and truly. William Osler was a prolific writer, and he wrote that textbook of medicine through 7 editions. And in the last one that he wrote himself in 1909, He wrote, no single remedy is of special value. Arsenic is in full doses helpful to some. Fresh air, good food, hydrotherapy, massage, hot air, and systematic exercises. So that was all that he had to offer. Renoir had taken his advice. In 1903, he moved away from Paris, bought himself a house in the south of France, and he painted his new house. And you can see the way he holds his brush, which is quite a testimony to his increasing difficulty. It also shows that his brushwork has probably changed from a fine to a more coarse. It could also be a change in impressionist style, which was going on at that time, but we will never know. Between 1903 and 5, William Osler stirred controversy with his fixed period speech. I'm talking about this today because he then voiced a view that when people had lived their useful lives, that there should be a way in which they can be terminated. Something about euthanasia, which was extremely controversial at that time. He also got appointed as Regius Professor of Medicine at Oxford University. So if you look at treatment of arthritis between 1910 and 1950, we had salicylates, which Osler had debunked. We had trial of injectable gold, and we had antimalarials, which were coming in. So there wasn't an awful lot that could be offered at that time. And part of the reason why progress was so slow was that diagnosis was a serious problem. That was a set of criteria put out in 1958. And you can see there is a long list here. They talk about subcutaneous nodules, which occur in a very small percentage of patients. Typical radiology, rheumatoid factor, synovial fluid, synovial histology, doing a biopsy, a nodule histology, plus 20 exclusions. At that stage, rheumatoid arthritis was a diagnosis of exclusion. It was not a positive diagnosis. It was a diagnosis that medicine did not want to make. And hence, its treatment was slow and tardy. So if we just look at a summary of this, there was stiffness, pain, tenderness, joint involvement, and a lot of stuff which we will see became progressively more redundant. What did this lead to? This led to the emergence in the 1960s, 1980s, to a treatment pyramid. I've used this picture, which is a picture of King Djoser's pyramid in Egypt, deliberately, because in the forefront, that is the detritus of history, and I would like to use it as a symbol of the 20 exclusions that patients had to go through before somebody actually made the diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis. They then reached level 1, where they got salicylates, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, and they waited. And they waited for a response that probably never came. And then, more out of desperation than out of design, they moved to the next step up. They got antimalarials and gold. A luckier few got some penicillamine, and steroids and cytotoxic agents were reserved for those people who persisted in getting to the top and hadn't died in between. So all in all, it was a very unsatisfactory treatment arrangement. The treatment, the drugs used, in the 1950s we had corticosteroids and gold. In the 1960s, the steroids had disappeared, and I'll come back to that a little later. In the 70s, you had methotrexate added on, antimalarials, and sulfasalazine. And in the 1980s, the corticosteroids made a comeback. And we'll talk about that later. So what happened? What converted this therapeutically sterile environment into an environment of different proportions? This is, of course, Gandhi Bhavan in Chandigarh, which you will all recognize in case you've been there. It's smack in the middle of Punjab University. And I decided to use the roof of this building to signify some of the changes in arthritis that occurred around this time. In the 1980s, those criteria were revised, the diagnostic criteria. And you can see already there is a far more manageable number. And those 20 exclusions are now a part of history. So people had the confidence to make this diagnosis without having to recourse to all that. So let's look at the treatment. So at the first spike, at the very beginning, when you made the diagnosis, the plan became for early disease-modifying drug therapy, either singly or 2 to 3 drugs, depending on severity, and the use of bridging corticosteroids. If this disease was responsive, you would taper the dose of the drugs. So that slope downwards signifies a tapering of the dose of drugs. If the disease came back, escalate if inadequate in response, and a consideration of the biological DMARDs that were on the horizon then and are very much part of what we do today. If there was a sudden worsening, this spike represented a pulse of corticosteroids, which is another therapeutic strategy that we use to control inflammation acutely. And if the disease process did not respond, you escalated DMARDs, revisit previously effective agents, and move towards the management with biologic drugs. So this is pretty much the paradigm for the management of this condition today. And the roof of Gandhi Bhavan shows it in analogy. In the 1990s, we've had a few more drugs added on. So what did all of this achieve? It achieved between 1958 and 1987 a rationalization of the diagnosis and an activation of the treatment. So the paradigm shift that occurred was between diagnostic delays, lack of therapeutic urgency, gradual increments of drugs, single drugs, and a policy of procrastination in treatment, to a quick and positive diagnosis, a need to induce remission, flexible patient-driven therapeutic approach using a combination of drugs characterized by a therapeutic urgency. And that was the difference. So we'll come back to our main players. In 1910, Renoir was well advanced in his rheumatoid arthritis, and you can see the deformities in his hands, which were quite severe, but he still painted this self-portrait. So he could still work, and he did, and he continued to work. And the skill is still there, although some of the finesse may have gone. In 1910, William Osler founded the Postgraduate Medical Association, which is still alive in UK today, and was its founder president. So what has happened since that time to the diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis? Today is a digital and numerical age. Right now, we have become attuned to this kind of scheme. So there is joint involvement, serology, duration of symptoms, and acute phase reactants. So this is simple, clinical. Serology is the rheumatoid factor and cyclic citrullinated peptide. So everything has got a score. Acute phase reactants are what we measure to quantify inflammation, and the duration is self-explanatory. So there are four major domains. You add up the score, and a score of 6 is equal to a diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis. So, in essence, between 1958 and 2010, you can see that we have worked towards a simplification and quantification of diagnosis, and this is what is going to be used in therapy for the future. We come back to our painter. This is a photograph of Renoir with his wife and son. And as you can see, he's quite seriously troubled by his arthritis. You see the shape of his thumb, you see his mangled hands, and this was a portrait that he painted of his wife at that stage. In 1912, the monarch made William Osler a baronet. I want to take some time and talk to you about corticosteroids. I know all of you have heard of these drugs, and they are, in popular folklore, drugs that are to be avoided at all cost. Isn't that what you perceive them to be? I'm sure you'll agree. I beg to disagree in a way. So this was one of the quickest Nobel Prizes in history. The drug was announced as a success in January, and the Nobel came through, was presented in December. So in 9 months, Kendall, Reichstein, and Hench got the Nobel Prize in Medicine for corticosteroids. So the clinical use of corticosteroids was dramatic, was widespread, and then, unfortunately, it turned deadly. And that is the reason why, because the side effects of obesity, diabetes, electrolyte problems, hypothalamic pituitary axis suppression, growth retardation, Addison's like hypertension, infections, osteoporosis, myopathy, necrosis of bone, pancreatitis, psychosis, depression, all of these emerged from the woodwork. And that was the reason why the problems with this drug were perhaps justified. So there was a retribution, a scientific and otherwise retribution, which was swift, very long-lasting, and equally deadly, because it did deprive medical science of a molecule and a group of drugs which have a profound role to play in control of inflammation, provided they are judiciously used. So this became part of popular folklore, and it was not uncommon for them to be considered the ultimate embodiment of evil, to have people say that I'd rather die than take steroids, and you'll hear that if you're a medical person from patients every day. Steroids nahi lene, I'm not going to take steroids. And you had a group of physicians who said, I'd rather my patient go blind, compromise his kidneys, brain, lungs, heart, and liver, than give him steroids that can help him. And that was the cynicism of the medical profession. It took a long time for them to return. Their clinical reuse of corticosteroids was slow and reluctant. In rheumatology, a study by Dr. Kirwan was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1982, and from then on, scientific rheumatology started to use the drugs. Even now, the use is reluctant at best and almost apologetic, which is unfair. You use terms like steroid sparing agents, which goes with the testimony of their being the embodiment of evil. But steroids are cyclophosphamide sparing agents and cyclosporin sparing agents in their own right. So we'll look at one problem. This is Harvey Cushing. Harvey Cushing was the father of neurosurgery, and he was also an esteemed medical writer. He wrote a biography of William Osler, for which he won a Pulitzer Prize, the only medical person to have won a Pulitzer Prize for biography, and his biography of William Osler is famous. So he described steroid-induced osteoporosis in a disease which was characterized by excessive steroid production. It's called Cushing syndrome. and that is what he wrote. So the steroid-induced osteoporosis is the commonest cause of secondary osteoporosis. There are fractures in 30 to 50% of long-term users. Even low doses of steroids every day, it causes cancellous bone areas and vertebrae and neck of femur to undergo changes. But today we understand a lot more about this. We understand, for instance, that there are osteoclasts, which are cells that eat up the bone. There are osteocytes and osteoblasts that build up bone. And with steroid and the effects on proliferation and protein synthesis and cell death, that there is a net reduced formation of bone as well as increased resorption of bone. We also know that corticosteroids can affect the intestine and the renal tubule to affect calcium status, and that this, through the parathyroid gland, can increase resorption of bone. So we know what happens. But as an example, with most steroid side effects, today we have learned that groups of drugs like bisphosphonates and teriparatide can all work towards alleviating this problem. So we have solutions today where none existed in the past. Coming back to Renoir, you can now see that he's on a wheelchair. He's got his hands in real trouble, but his skill as a painter still continues. It's now 1915. It's about 25 years since he got the disease. We know he has serious hand deformities, and we'll come to another picture later on which will show just what he was doing. And he was likely to have experienced problems of pain, stiffness, fatigue, sleep, and emotional issues. Now, I think he'd lost his wife by then, so he had lots of problems. And I'll take a few minutes to talk about pain. Pain is the commonest symptom that brings patients to a hospital or to medical attention. It has some peculiar characteristics. One, that it is impossible to quantify. If I ask you what your pain levels are or what kind of pain you are experiencing and you say it's 5 out of 10, how do we know it's the same quantum of pain affecting somebody sitting next to you and they also say 5 out of 10? The chances are they might say 1 out of 10 or 9 out of 10. So it is something that is based on communication. You've got to take a patient's word for it. The second problem is that you cannot feel what others feel. We must remember that pain has some functions. So if your hand is getting caught in the door of the car that's being slammed and you withdraw your hand, the pain is a protective phenomenon. Chronic pain, on the other hand, is a self-perpetuating phenomenon with neural and chemical influences that govern its progression. It can also be related to inflammation, and there is non-inflammatory or mechanical pain, which is due to wear and tear. So these are painful hands. There is swelling, redness, pain, and it's quite obvious that this person must be in some pain. But do you associate pain with this face? You do not. And yet, this young lady is Frida Kahlo, the famous Mexican painter, who had an accident in her young age, and she painted this broken column in 1944. And you can see that she has put pins through her, demarcating the various points that were paining, the broken spine that she symbolized with this broken column. And this is the same set of points that ultimately became what was used by the American Society for Pain as a definition of a condition called fibromyalgia, a chronic, widespread, persistent pain. This is a vicious circle. So the pain begets anxiety, depression, negative thoughts, breeds inactivity, isolation, and becoming of a recluse, and there is activation of the pain matrix in the brain that perpetuates this problem. Very difficult vicious cycle to break. Stiffness is another problem. It can be inflammatory. If it is, it worsens with rest. It can last for hours. Patients with inflammatory stiffness usually say that the afternoon is the best time of the day. How do you treat it? Heat, massage, quite a bit like what Osler recommended. Of course, the drugs are an entirely different story, which we've already talked about. Fatigue. Fatigue has many causes. So arthritis patients suffering from fatigue can have fatigue due to just inflammation, or they may have fatigue due to anemia of iron deficiency, which we have to look at, which is fairly common in these people, due to diabetes or an underperforming thyroid, which we need to look at. So there are a lot of things that one need to look at to try and figure out what are the complexities of the management of such a patient. Other causes include other inflammatory diseases. So having rheumatoid arthritis does not vaccinate somebody against having some other disease process, which may be inflammatory in nature and which can produce the same sort of problems. The other thing that happens with arthritis patients is, because of their joint problems, there is an increased effort that is required to accomplish everyday activity, with the result that they get exhausted doing things that we normally take for granted. It's a combination of pain and stiffness, and also immobility that causes this fatigue. The other problem is that on the rare good day that they have, when they are relatively free of pain, they are trying to catch up with all the things that they have avoided doing for so long. And then when they take these 6 steps forward, the next day they take 16 steps back, because their bodies can't cope with this problem. There are sleep-related issues, which are some things that we need to address. So, you can now see that in 1917, Renoir was still in his wheelchair. There was a younger woman in his life. And you can see these two marks across the dorsum of his hands, because he could no longer hold a brush. And he had them taped to his hands so that he could continue to paint. This is a painting of his agent, Mr. Walhard, who was responsible for selling most of his paintings. It hasn't projected particularly well, but it does show a definite coarsening of his brushwork, entirely commensurate with the fact that he wasn't using his fingers to hold his brushes. But he still continued to work. In the same year, William Osler's only son died of war injuries in the First World War. What can we do to help our arthritis patients? We need to tell them unhelpful things are smoking. We know now that smoking is directly related to rheumatoid arthritis. It's related because the antibody that's supposed to trigger the process is antibodies to a cyclic citrullinated peptide. And we know the most powerful stimulus for the citrullination of proteins is cigarette smoke. So it's as close to a smoking gun in all intentions possible that we have in addressing the cause of rheumatoid arthritis, one cause of rheumatoid arthritis. Excessive alcohol never helped anybody. Inactivity and weight gain are other factors that make arthritis difficult. What is helpful is to exercise within limits. And limits is the important thing here, is the cornerstone. That it's not a good idea for people to overdo it and then do nothing at all for several days trying to recover. It's always important to try and have a forward trajectory. It's also important to remember that while doctors and medicine emphasize exercise, they should also emphasize that rest is equally important. periods of rest between exercise are very important, because exercising an inflamed joint is like adding insult to injury. We need to protect joints, so don't over-exercise them, don't overdo things, choose the correct exercise, good nutrition, being sociable, understanding of your problems are important. And work as much as one is, it's possible. So Teddy Roosevelt said, far the most and away the best prize that life has to offer is a chance to work hard at work worth doing, like all of you. So we talk about work, and this is a collage of Renoir's hands at three periods or towards the end of his life. So they were savaged by disease, and yet this man continued to work. In December of 1919, both Renoir and our physician died. Both died of pneumonia. Renoir was still trying to get hold of a palette and canvas to paint the woodcocks that he was seeing in his dying delirium. And William Osler was seeking the answers that he never found as to why he had to lose his son. What was the message? The message in this talk that I've given you today is one that there is hope for the arthritis patient, and a message of cautious optimism. And that I would like to acknowledge my patients with arthritis for the lessons that they have taught me, which I have very often, very reluctantly learnt. I want to give you a bibliography, and that's William Osler's book, the neurosurgical classic, Osler's textbook revisited, and Renoir's Life, Art and Letters, Abrams, 1984. I want to thank you for your attention, and I'll be very happy to take any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Dr. Pradeep. I think we can have another 10 minutes.
Can you hear me? Yeah. Rheumatoid arthritis does not involve the spine, usually, except the neck. The cervical spine has got large synovial joints which allow the neck to move. It's the most mobile part of the spine. The lower spine is more fixed and structural and weight-bearing, whereas the cervical spine or the neck is more mobile. And that's the reason why there are a lot of synovial joints there. So rheumatoid arthritis does affect the cervical spine, but it usually does not affect the thoracic or the lumbar spine. Yes?
Yeah. As Dr. Arkin says that now we know only when you have pain, we know you have arthritis. In early stage, how do you know when it just started?
Well, the symptoms could be fatigue, it could be a little bit of fever, it could be just feeling unwell. So it's relatively non-specific, the early symptoms. There are, can I just have a quick sip? There's some very interesting data that's available, because the US Army takes a blood sample from everybody in the Army every year. So the people who developed rheumatoid arthritis, they went back to their serum samples that had been stored. And they found that rheumatoid factor and CCP antibodies started to appear fairly long time before symptoms actually accrued or appeared. So it's a disease process that started off. It's taken enough a fair amount of time before it reached a critical mass that allowed it to become symptomatic. So, yes, if you, you know, in the future, and we're talking about the future of personalized medicine. You can think about a brave new world where everyone is gene typed at birth, and they will tell you that you have the right configuration, you have the right HLA molecules. So the chances are that you're going to develop rheumatoid arthritis, start getting your blood tests done the moment the factor becomes available, start taking treatment. And they will also probably tell you which drugs will work and which will not. So that's crystal ball gazing. It's in the future, but that probably will happen. Yes? In very resistant cases, injectable gold is used. There are two salts, sodium orothiomalate and sodium orothioglucose. They were the two drugs that were used. One was called myocrycin, the other was called solgonal. They are seldom used today because gold produces a lot of renal toxicity. So it produces nephrotic syndrome, it produces damage to the kidney. It's a drug that is not generally useful for long periods of time. If you start 100 people on gold, it will show continued efficacy enough to be therapeutically viable in probably about 20% at 2 years. So 80% of people will have come off it by then. But both these salts were used. It's a very interesting story that this was the first large multinational drug trial that was ever performed in modern medicine. There was a British Empire gold arthritis study in the 1930s. So it was a landmark study, but the drug is not used. At the present moment, I have only one patient on gold who's been on gold for 25 years, and for her it continues to work. So we just keep giving it. Yes?
We often hear the,
go ahead.
We often hear the term osteoarthritis. Is it different from this rheumatoid arthritis?
Yes, it is. Osteoarthritis is a wear and tear arthritis. So it's an arthritis that arises out of bone rubbing on bone. Inflammation does occur in this, but it occurs as a consequence of mechanical stress. Inflammation is not a dominant feature in these joints, although recent studies have shown that anti-inflammatories do work to alleviate some of the symptoms. But certainly the driving force is not an inflammatory process. It is a mechanical process of stress and shear that produces these problems. You had a question.
Yes, that was exactly my question. And I also wanted to know if there were any recent advances in treatment of osteoarthritis.
There are lots of advances that last for a short while. So people inject all kinds of things into joints. None of them work. People will ask you to take chondroitin and glucosamine, which is worse. Some of them are worse than placebo. So it's a waste of money. Of course, if they give you a sense of satisfaction, and that's the important thing. There is an enormous interplay between your acceptance of a remedy and its efficacy. If you mentally accept a remedy, it is likely, or you're comfortable with it, it's more likely to be efficacious. But joint injections with the hyaluronate, you've got to do it very, very early at a time where when you're barely symptomatic. So nobody is going to do it. Glucosamine and chondroitin, they say that these proteins are assembled, that cartilage proteins get assembled in the joints, which is really funny because you're supposed to eat them and then your stomach and intestines digest them. And how do they miraculously get reconstituted in a joint? I do not know. But all trials have proved that some of them are worse than useless, but none of them have any sustained benefit. So it's a waste of money. It's a huge industry, but it's a waste of money. Other treatments, yes. There is a recognition that there is a component of inflammation in osteoarthritis as well. It's not as dominant as in rheumatoid arthritis, And some of the drugs that we use, the anti-inflammatory drugs that I've talked about, will also help alleviate some symptoms of osteoarthritis. But the management of osteoarthritis is a way of protection of joints, try and avoid doing the things that induce pain, and use the pain then as a barometer of what you're doing, where you need to tread, where you need to, so that it helps you decide when you need to rest, when you need to exercise, and the optimization of exercise.
Could we possibly avoid the development of further osteoarthritis changes if we start cordyceps exercises right in the beginning?
Well, losing weight is the first thing, and I'm not a very good example of that, I'm afraid, but losing weight is the first thing to reduce osteoarthritis of the knees. Quadriceps exercises are great, but you can do them sitting on a bicycle. You don't have to do them on a treadmill or walking on hard ground or jogging, because if you do that, what you're doing when you're jogging is you're pounding your knee menisci with everything. So if you're sitting on a bicycle, your upper body weight is on the seat, and the weight being transmitted through your knees is much lower. So that's what I was saying, being sensible about exercise. You could sit on a rower. Again, your body is sitting on a seat. The movement of the legs will strengthen your quadriceps, but there will be less pressure injury. Swimming is a wonderful exercise to develop all your musculature, non-weight bearing. So these are some of the things that you need to do. Yes? Go ahead.
You said that being sociable could help. Mm-hmm.
You can't quantify that.
Related to the efficacy of this.
All right. You know, if you are able to move around, meet people, listen to other people's stories, the chances are that you will try and forget some of your own problems. And that's what being sociable means. Being a social animal. I'm afraid there are no scores or no scales that I'm aware of that can judge how sociable you are. But certainly, communication, interaction with people is something that alleviates symptoms. Somebody, quite a few hands. Go ahead.
Can arthritis be induced because of other medicines you are taking?
Yes, some forms of arthritis. Biggest example is gout. Gout can be induced by diuretics that you take for control of hypertension. Gout can be induced by taking pyrazinamide for the treatment of tuberculosis, and there are many other examples. So you can get arthritis as a consequence of drug therapy, most certainly. Yes?
What are the chances of remission in rheumatoid arthritis?
A very difficult question. What are the chances of remission? Well, I'll tell you why they want to induce a remission in the first place. I want to induce a remission because it's been shown that severe, aggressive, untreated rheumatoid arthritis has the same survival characteristics or mortality figures as people with triple vessel coronary artery disease and with Hodgkin's disease, which is a lymphoma, which is a malignant tumor. Same life expectancy. So there is an urgent need to induce a remission to try and stem this inevitable tide towards destruction. What are the chances? The sooner you intervene, the better it is. If you intervene within the first 6 months of the start of disease, when you are just made the diagnosis, there are clear studies that have shown that the use of DMARDs, or the drugs that we talked about, within the first 6 months, reduces the number of people with deformities later on in life. And the erosions that are the hallmark of this disease may actually disappear on treatment. So, I can't tell you the exact numbers, but a definition of remission is based on a calculation. It's called a DAS score. If you've got a DAS score less than 2.8, means you have gone into remission. The trouble is that the disease waxes and wanes. There are relapses and remissions. It goes up and down. And the important thing is to keep it closed, keep it covered, and keep it suppressed for long enough. And that is where the use of several agents comes in, because combinations of drugs. These days, people will accept up to 10 milligrams of prednisone every day, which is corticosteroids. The idea is to slowly taper, slowly bring the dose of drugs down. There are enormous number of guidelines for the initiation of therapy. There are none for its cessation. So treatment is very long, sometimes very frustrating, but the objective is to try and minimize the problems that arise. Now, people with rheumatoid arthritis die of increased infections, die of vascular disease. So strokes and heart attacks are much more common in these people, because the inflammatory process in itself promotes the development of the atheroma. So it produces the chemical messengers that drive the atheromatous process. And that's the reason why you need to suppress it. Does that answer your question? Yes. Partially. All right. Yes, please.
Ranoir's condition. Ranoir's condition, which we just saw, is that severe situation, or is that?
Yeah, it's severe rheumatoid arthritis. Not everyone. You can have people with rheumatoid arthritis who had it for 40 years, whose hands look like mine. There are others who have it for 5 years and they are bent like that, much worse than this. So, if you ask me, why does that happen? I do not know, but I guess that it would be because of your genetic makeup, because ultimately it's an interaction between your genes, your environment, and the immune system.
As per the diagnostic criteria, there is zero negative and zero positive rheumatoid arthritis. Does the treatment change with the zero negative status? So then what is the role of doing the test rheumatic factor?
Alright, the test, if you are high titer rheumatoid factor positive and high titer CCP positive, then you are the kind of singled out as a kind of person who develops the serious complications of rheumatoid arthritis. So people who are seronegative and who have got a disease that resembles rheumatoid arthritis generally do not have the major serious systemic consequences. People who are rheumatoid factor positive, people who are CCP positive, are the ones who are naturally selected towards a more troublesome or bad outcome. Let somebody, yes. Well, it depends upon your surgeon and depends on if you can keep infection at bay. Very good results, lasts about 15 years, not longer than that. So, and redos are a problem. So the aim is to try and do them as late as possible. But it's a tightrope walk. It's a tightrope walk because the longer you use osteoarthritic knees, the longer these things are compacting, the bone becomes soft, it expands. So you have to put in a larger prosthesis. The larger prosthesis you put in, the more unstable it is. So you got to find the right time. And redoing it is a painful business. Yes, please.
Yeah, I mean, is there clear understanding the basic cause of this disease, why this should trigger, I mean, whether there are any statistical studies done, whether it affects female most?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. what is the cause of the disease? I alluded to that a little bit. There is a genetic framework that has gradually emerged. So there are people who are DR4 positive, people who have certain other HLA associations which are inherited. So you have an inherited framework on which this edifice is built. It also means that the immune response genes work in a way that is different from other people. It's an interaction with the immune system, and I think as time goes on, we will realize that interaction with the microbiome and the gut is of serious importance, because the The intestine is the largest immune organ in the whole body. It's bombarded by more antigens than any other part of the body. Of the food that we eat and the contaminants that come with the food and also the bacteria that we swallow. And also the very large population of bacteria that are resident in the intestine about which we know very little. So liquid contents in your ileum, which is the last part of the small intestine, may contain up to 10 to the power 8 organisms per ml. And that is the reason why we need to explore what is their relationship with the immune system. How are they modulating the immune system? Many people who get rheumatoid arthritis will point to a fact that they had an infected process, a serious infection a few weeks before this problem started. It's possible that an infection triggers it off in a susceptible person, and it's a coming together of two or three forces that allows a signal to pass, and after that, whether you treat the infection or you don't treat it, it doesn't matter, because then it becomes a self-perpetuating cycle. So I really don't know what the answer is, but certainly it's a complex interaction between the environment, microbes, the intestine, the immune system, and the genetic makeup of the individual. Because other people exposed to exactly the same may not get it.
May I request all of us to have a continuation of this discussion over a cup of coffee or tea? I think it's a very
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Pradeep.